Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. You know, initially, folks, I wasn't going to cover this case, but I think that it's pretty important to do so, to cover it, because they talk about this case, you know, the trial of the century, and there's the two faces of OJ there, who I incidentally knew him as a kid as this great running back. First of all, for the University of Southern California, where he won the Heisman Trophy. And then for the Buffalo Bills, where he totally destroyed my New York Jets in breaking the then NFL record of rushing for 2,000 yards in a season, in a 14-game season. So that's, you know, who we first came to know O.J. Simpson as this tremendous athlete. And then he ingratiated himself as an actor, as a spokesperson, as a sportscaster. And he was one of probably the most likable people in the biz. And when he was charged with the murders of Ronald Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. There's Nicole Brown Simpson on the screen, and is Ronald Goldman with his sister. It's almost like we didn't want to believe it. We didn't want to believe that this, you know, American icon, this all Hall of Fame football player could do something so horrific. But then it became something so much bigger than O.J. Simpson, Heisman Trophy winner, O.J. Simpson, NFL Hall of Fame running back, O.J. Simpson, actor, O.J. Simpson, sportcaster, O.J. It became O.J. Simpson, murderer. And when we looked into his background and we saw the domestic violence history that he had with his divorced wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, we started to believe that perhaps he was guilty of what he was charged with, you know. And then this case, of course, became, as they described it, as the trial of the century. And this case had every possible thing wrong with it that any criminal case could have. We have a judge, Judge Lance Ito, who became famous from this case, as did everyone involved in this case become famous. My biggest criticism of him was that he allowed a homicide case to go on for 9 months. That's outrageous. Meaning he allowed too many things into the case. Even the biggest homicide cases last 6 to 8 weeks, 10 weeks maximum. You're talking 9 months. That's outrageous. And that was how he, in my opinion, let this trial get away from him and let what was known back then as the Dream Team, who you see on the screen right now, more or less do whatever they wanted to do. And he was quite, I think, intimidated by them and allowed them way too much latitude to do whatever they wanted to do with this case. So we're going to discuss this case. We're going to look at it. We're going to look at how it became sort of a barometer for racial relations in this country. And we'll speak about that, and we'll speak about the victims, the family of Ronald Goldman, the family of Nicole Brown Simpson, and how this affected not just the people that were most intimately involved in it, the family members, but people throughout this country who were glued to their TV sets for 9 months that culminated in a not guilty verdict against O.J. Simpson. And we'll discuss that, how that occurred. So folks, hold on to your hats, hold on to your seats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone. We'll be right back.
me some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10 and Grant's microphone.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
You know, according to the New York Times in an article written on yesterday, April 11th, O.J. Simpson, who ran to fame on the football field, made fortunes as an All-American in movies, television, and advertising, and was acquitted of killing his former wife and her friend in a 1995 trial in Los Angeles that mesmerized the nation. He died on Wednesday at his home in Las Vegas. He was 76. The cause was cancer, his family announced on social media. The jury in the murder trial cleared him, but the case, which had held up a cracked mirror to Black, and this is according to the New York Times and White America, changed the trajectory of his life. In 1997, a civil suit by the victim's families found him liable for the deaths of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman and ordered him to pay $33.5 million in damages. He paid little of the debt, moved to Florida, and struggled to remake his life, raise his children, and stay out of trouble. In 2006, he sold a book manuscript titled If I Did It and a prospective TV interview giving a hypothetical account of murders he had always denied committing. A public outcry ended both projects, but Mr. Goldman's family secured the book rights, added the material, inputting guilt to Mr. Simpson, and had it published. In 2007, he was arrested after he and other men invaded a Las Vegas hotel room of some sports memorabilia dealers and took a trove of collectibles. He claimed that the items had been stolen from him, but a jury in 2008 found him guilty of 12 charges, including armed robbery and kidnapping, after a trial that drew only a smattering of reporters and spectators. He was sentenced to 9 to 33 years in a Nevada state prison. He served the minimum term and was released in 2017. The amazing thing, I think, about this case is, in my humble opinion, and many of you may disagree with me, I felt that O.J. Simpson was guilty as hell, that there was so much evidence that he did it, but the jury chose to ignore the evidence. Instead, believing the dream team that this was had to do with racism, had to do with a rogue LAPD detective by the name of Mark Furman, who planted evidence, and they created enough doubt in order for the jury to believe this. And that, to many people, was disturbing. And the fact that it was more or less opinions were split along racial lines. This was post-Rodney King, a defendant who was chased by the LAPD and in a nationally televised or repeat televised video of this, they beat him with nightsticks. A number of maybe 6 to 8 officers. And that became the incident that at the time poured gasoline on the LA riots and in fact started the LA riots. You know, Dan Abrams from News Nation, who is an attorney and a young reporter at the time, I'm going to play what he said. And this is very interesting because, as I said, many people in this case, their feelings were along racial lines. If you were white, you felt that he was guilty as hell. If you were Black, many people felt that he was innocent. And if he was guilty, that's too bad. This is payback. And that's what I think got a little bit upsetting for people, that they saw two people murdered. Yet that wasn't important, what had happened prior to this was more important. I'm going to play Dan Abrams right now.
Inside the courtroom, there aren't many of us. The reality is, his cases jump-started my career, and yet he was a murderer. That's sort of a troubling reality I've always had to live with, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. But
you know, I admire Dan Abrams's honesty because he, of course, we all know O.J. was acquitted, but he right here goes out and said he's a murderer. But yet many news reporters will be reluctant to say that because he was found not guilty by a court of law. But here's Dan Abrams saying he was a murderer.
I was 27, not even 2 years out of law school. I was a junior reporter at Court TV. And after the Bronco chase, after the world had been watching that incident, I was just sent out to cover the initial hearing in the case, right? The preliminary hearing where they determine, is there enough evidence to send O.J. Simpson to trial? And the only reason I was there is because the two main reporters at Court TV were busy on other assignments. So they needed someone to go to Los Angeles. They sent me out to cover that initial proceeding. And I had no sense that I was about to devote the next 2 years of my life to covering, you know, sort of the trial of a generation. I ended up mostly living in Los Angeles for the next 2 years. And covering the case was a bit surreal. This wasn't just a sort of a typical news story. It was much more than that. I mean, this was 9 months. And it often kind of played out like a soap opera. I mean, think about it.
You know, as I said earlier, here is Dan Abrams reporting, this trial was 9 months. That is unheard of. That is outrageous. That is ridiculous that a homicide trial can last 9 months. And it is all because, in my opinion, this man, he allowed, you know, he allowed 2 weeks to interview the DNA lab. 2 weeks, you know, in a New York trial, you'd get 3 hours to do that, not 2 weeks. And so as a result, of course, what was known as the dream team could eviscerate these lab technicians in regards to, and during this interview, the jury was sleeping. They couldn't understand half of it. So it was like, that's where the judge, Lance Ito, should have drawn a line in the sand and said, no, you get 3 hours, you get 5 hours, you get 1 day, whatever it was, not 2 weeks to interview lab technicians in regards to the DNA evidence.
In terms of the evidence in the case, right? Forensic scientists and DNA experts became household names. Even the most minor of participants became famous. I mean, you remember Barry Scheck, he was one of the lawyers, but you remember Gary Sims or Renee Montgomery? DNA or evidence experts? At the time, oh, Renee Montgomery. Those of us who covered the trial became sort of mini celebrities too. I was just a lawyer just out of law school, and suddenly I was in People magazine. Remember, it was such a different media world then than what we have now. We got the internet, we got streaming, we got the ability for everyone to show it. Back then, broadcast networks weren't going to cover it gavel to gavel. The other stuff they had to show, and they had to pretend like they didn't care about this case. But CNN and Court TV were the two places you went to watch this case. And this was the beginning of cable news. This is when cable news was just starting to kind of explode. So, you know, many of the media entities that kind of take themselves very seriously didn't want to cover the story at first. New York Times and the Washington Post and the broadcast networks, but they eventually gave in. Every single day was an event. And I think that's part of why the case became kind of a national obsession. Now, it was a huge difference between what was happening inside the courtroom and what was happening outside. All right. Outside the courthouse, it was nuts. There were vendors hawking t-shirts and jewelry, baseball caps, and, you know, for example, there was a watch being sold that had the second hand of a police car chasing a Bronco. There was a Jell-O mold of Judge Ito's face. There were board games of the O.J. Simpson case. There was a baseball.
You know, just to make a little comment on what Dan Abrams is talking about, that's one of the dangers, and we've discussed it here, of cameras in the courtroom. This case became, it was bigger than any TV show. It was live, a live trial that, you know, millions of people were watching every day. When this case was over, the prosecutor, Marcia Clark, signed a $4 million book deal. So it was like people were getting rich off the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. And OJ, of course, walked. He walked away free. And serious-minded people, I think, can't even stomach the thought that he is, OJ Simpson, was even remotely innocent. And when you mention to people that actually believe it, they get highly insulted. And in my opinion, I think this was a case of jury nullification, meaning they could have, and Geraldo Rivera actually said the same thing. I didn't get this from him. I had thought this before, that they could have watched videotape of this murder with a clear shot of OJ's face doing it, and they still would have let him walk. It was absolutely jury nullification. No matter what the evidence was, they were not going to convict him. And I firmly believe that. And as we said, there was a huge divide in this country, right down the middle, in according to what race you were, on how you felt about this case. I'm not saying every single black person thought he was innocent. I'm not saying every single white person thought he was guilty. But the evidence in this case was, to me, overwhelming that he did it. And yet they disregarded that evidence and he was acquitted.
Ball cap made for every single lawyer. I mean, you could buy a Gerald Ullman baseball cap. He was a law professor that the defense brought in for part of the case. But inside the courtroom, where I spent so many days, we were all very tightly compacted in there, right? Because any seat in that courtroom was jealously protected. And it was a different world. There were rules that you had to abide by. I remember at one point, there was a rule of no gum chewing allowed in the courtroom. And apparently Judge Ito, who had his own camera facing towards the gallery, spotted me chewing gum. And I got approached and challenged about it. And I remember saying at the time, well, you know, I got, because you were allowed to have sucking candy, just no gum. And I remember saying at the time, well, you know, someone gave me what I thought was a candy, and it turned out to be a chiclet. So it turned into gum. But anyway, I was let to go on it.
This is just sort of showing you how ridiculous the trial had gotten, and how, you know, what was really important? Was the gum chewing important, or was reining in people and establishing a framework in this trial so that people weren't allowed to interview witnesses for 2 and 3 weeks? You know, I think that was more important than gum chewing. You know, go back to Dan Abrams.
Big picture in the criminal case, the evidence was overwhelming, right? Bloody glove. Remember, one was found at his home, the other at the crime scene. Nicole had bought him these exact gloves. The blood of OJ and the victims in his car, the unexplained cuts on his hands, blood found at Simpson's home. Nicole having put pictures of her beaten face in a safe deposit box just in case? Or it's presumably OJ's hair found at the crime scene and on Ron Goldman? It was fiber evidence? The killer's bloody footprint being OJ's size, 12, very big. Nicole's blood found on his sock. It was a mountain of evidence.
It's when you hear, as Dan Abrams is recounting the evidence, any one of those things potentially could be enough in a murder trial to get someone convicted. But he listed about 8 or 10 pieces of physical evidence that, apparently that wasn't good enough for the jury. They can't believe he did it. His blood is in the crime scene. His blood, Nicole Brown's blood, is on his socks. The gloves had his blood on. I mean, just outrageous. This is the amount of evidence, yet think of that word, jury nullification.
Evidence like I have never seen in a case that has gone to trial, ever. But despite all of that, those of us who were in court every day were not surprised by the verdict. Maybe we were a little surprised by how quickly it came in after such a long trial. We weren't surprised by the verdict. And it's not because the prosecutors screwed up the presentation of the evidence. They were okay. They were fine. The screw-up was the moment prosecutors decided to try the case in downtown LA instead of Santa Monica. And in jury selection, the big mistake that they made was they presumed that black women in particular would relate to domestic violence. And there's no doubt that O.J. Simpson had a history of domestic violence with Nicole Brown. But that did not end up being the dominant issue. The dominant issue ended up being race. It was simply too fraught a time in Los Angeles, so soon after Rodney King. Again, Marsha Clark and Chris Darden did a perfectly fine job. Yes, they shouldn't have had OJ try on the glove. That was dumb.
Yes. All right. Thank you, counsel.
I was thinking.
This last night, Cochran on the screen.
About this case and their theory and how it didn't make any sense and how it didn't fit and how something is wrong. And it occurred to me how they were going to come here and stand up here and tell you how O.J. Simpson was going to disguise himself. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
But that didn't determine the outcome. It was the relationship between the community and the police. And most importantly, the minute the defense was allowed to talk about race, and you could throw in someone like Mark Furman, and they were able to chronicle racist things he had said in the past. There's no way Mark Furman could have planted the glove. No way. But the things he said were ugly. And that was devastating to the case because it gave jurors something to hang their hats on. Look, the defense big picture, the theory was absurd. The police were both completely incompetent in how they handled evidence. They messed this up, they dropped this, they were sloppy, but when it came to planting evidence, they were masterful. The jury was never going to convict this man at this time.
Just as I said, and Dan Abrams is reiterating that, is that this is known as jury nullification. No matter what, as I said, and I think Geraldo Rivera said it, they could have watched a videotape of him committing these murders. They wouldn't have convicted them. And I, like, look, there's no doubt that, you know, this team of attorneys were good attorneys. But they also threw in, you know, the specter and the area that this trial was allowed to be tried in. That benefited them tremendously. There was also something earlier on in the case, and this goes to police work. And at some point, OJ was brought into the police station, and he was interviewed by Detective Lang and Venata, two old-time detectives. Had, you know, they were up there in age. They were, you know, extreme veterans. And I remember that they had interviewed him or interrogated him, whatever you want to call it, and he had a cut on his hand, which, you know, we all know that most of the time when someone stabs people, they wind up cutting themselves because the blood gets on the knife gets slippery, and the hand slides on the knife and winds up cutting the assailant also. So he had a cut like that. And that could be the cut from which his blood was found in the crime scene, was found on some items of evidence. But Lang and Venata, and again, this is this is 30 years ago. Basically, in the NYPD, if we had a defendant like that in the box, as we call it, he's not leaving unless he invokes counsel. He's not leaving. He's going to be in there for as long as we need to interview him. And once he says, I want an attorney, or am I under arrest? And if you don't have probable cause at that point, then you have to let him go. But they did what I thought was a little bit of a short interview, and he walked out of the station house. And they lost a tremendous opportunity because his time frame and his answers were not truthful. But they somehow let him walk out. And I always felt, well, these were two veteran detectives. Why did they let him leave? Why did they let him walk out of that station house? And that always puzzled me. And I thought that was a missed opportunity.
That simple. OJ's legal team knew just the right buttons to push. Led by Johnny Cochran, Johnny became a dear friend of mine after the case. He quickly took over as OJ's lead lawyer. Johnny Cochran knew that OJ was guilty. Did he ever tell me, Dan, OJ was guilty? No, he did not. He never said those words. But in the context of conversations we had, it was clear he knew. And I think that goes for probably the entire defense team, with the exception of one person. F. Lee Bailey came very famous in the 1970s. He, I think, was a true believer. Maybe the only one on OJ's so-called dream team who actually thought OJ didn't do it. Now, obviously, there's, you know, there's so much focus on the criminal case today, right? Nation stopped, criminal verdict came back in. But as I look back, I often think about the civil trial, which was really interesting in its own way, because we had much more access to O.J. Simpson during the civil trial, right? I would talk to O.J. in the hallway during breaks in the case, and he would obsess over the most irrelevant details. I mean, for example, he would talk about some testimony that had happened, right? I remember there was something about when he had played golf the next day, okay? He's raging about it. He, that guy said that I was playing golf at 1 o'clock. I couldn't have possibly been playing golf. He knows that. It was completely irrelevant to the case itself. But what people forget is he testified in the civil case. He had to answer questions under oath, which he didn't have to do in the criminal trial. And he did terribly. And so I have a lot of people who say to me after the case, well, Dan, I had questions. Well, the jury found reasonable doubt. Okay. You cannot have any doubt after the civil case. Remember, those size 12 Bruno Mali shoes, they knew about that in the criminal case. That was the bloody footprint. They were able to identify the shoe. They tried to link it back to O.J. Simpson. They were close. They couldn't quite do it. O.J. Simpson was asked, under oath, what about Bruno Mali's shoes? Said, I never would have worn those ugly-ass shoes. That was a quote. Lo and behold, before the civil trial started, the lawyers for Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman were able to find a newsletter from the Buffalo Bills, where he had played, from 8 months before the murders. And there he is, wearing the ugly shoes. So now you have the bloody footprint at the scene, size 12 OJ size, and you have him now wearing the shoes.
You know, very interesting. However, that at that point, you know, wasn't going to help the criminal case. You know, we sort of posture about this stuff now, but this was all of this information, all of this evidence. So bring another wheelbarrow full of evidence. This jury would have still ignored it. They would have still ignored the evidence. And, you know, he's talking about the civil trial that went down years later. I want to play this. This was sort of interesting because I find a lot of news reporters, even to this day, they're acting as if he didn't do it, you know, because he was acquitted. And Geraldo, to his credit, on social media, made some very profound statements. And he was on Banfield talking. And I want to play it because, you know, Geraldo at one time was, back in the day, was a great reporter. He's up in age right now. He's, you know, he's not as good as he once was, but he still, he has that that great depth and that great collection of all the work he's done during his life. And he's done some outstanding work. So I want to give Geraldo, we want to listen to what he said or what he wrote on social media. And Banfield talks about it.
News Nation's correspondent at large, Geraldo Rivera, discussed the racial undertones of the OJ case on social media. And this is what he wrote. Very interesting. Simpson exploited our nation's racial divide to avoid being found guilty of the brutal slasher killings he perpetrated on Nicole Brown Simpson, his children's mother, and her friend Ron Goldman. The diametrically opposed reaction in real time of the elated Black community and the outraged white community to the verdict spoke more potently about America's racial divide than any thoughtful essay ever could. And Geraldo Rivera joins me live now. Geraldo, you and I talk about so many crimes of the day, and here we are, both of us having digested this one for the last three decades. You also wrote, even videotape of the murders would not have been enough to convict popular Black football and Teflon media hero O.J. Simpson. Do you think that this was truly the payback that juror, Carrie Bess, said 90% of her fellow panelists felt?
I am not surprised. I think that it was a very profoundly moving and telling statement from the former juror. I absolutely agree with it. It's something that you sense. It was really choosing up sides, whether it was in a university or in a business or a man on the street, even in prisons, everywhere. There was cheering and tears. It was a horribly, profoundly divisive verdict, a moment in time, a moment in history. It was a reaction to Rodney King. It was a reaction to a lot of bitterness, a lot of incidents that have happened over the decades, the long generations of our existence as a nation. It's so telling and depressing because it is real and it haunts us, Ashley, to this very day.
Thank you for watching.
So a profound statement by Geraldo, because as I said, many news reporters are still acting as if, oh, he was acquitted. He died an innocent man. Is there anyone out there that that thinks that OJ died an innocent man. Well, according to the record, he was acquitted in that case, right? So he was acquitted. So yeah, he was innocent in that way, but he was found guilty after a civil trial that uncovered many of the things that the criminal trial created doubt upon. And I want to play a little bit of K-Me, thank you, a member for 14 months. Wow, thank you for joining us. Thank you for supporting Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. This is from Ron Goldman's father. And, you know, talk about the victims in this case, the Goldman family, who really was innocent as all hell. He just happened to be with Nicole Brown when her, when OJ came a-calling, you know. And, you know, you talk about even murders like this too, motive. He had all the motive in the world, and he had opportunity, he had desire. He had a history of domestic violence that they just poo-pooed, you know, because he had this reputation as this real good guy, you know, this nice, nice guy. Oh, no, he would never do that, you know. This is the Hertz. The Hertz rent-a-car spokesperson. This is the actor, you know. This is the Hall of Fame football player. But what people didn't know, he was also a wife abuser, a domestic violence person. And did the jury even consider that? You know, I don't know. I don't know what they considered. This was a case of jury nullification. This is from Ron Goldman's father. You can read this on the screen.
Of OJ's death that said, "The only thing that I have to say today is that this is a further reminder of the loss of my son, Ron. It is a further reminder of my son's murder and a reminder about the many years we have missed Ron. OJ Simpson's death is a reminder that Ron and Nicole were murdered by him. I am not going to react to my thoughts about him dying. I have nothing to say about him. My response will not be about OJ's death, but about the loss of my son's life by him. Also reacting to OJ's death is Cato Kalin, a star witness during that murder trial. Kalin was living in a guest house on OJ's property at the time of the murder. He put out this statement a little earlier.
I've been asked to comment on the death of OJ Simpson. Foremost, I'd like to express my condolences to the children, to Sydney and to Justin, to Jason and Arnell. They lost their father, and that is never easy. I wish to express my love and compassion to the Goldmans, to Fred and to Kim. I hope you find closure. And finally, to the family of the beautiful Nicole Brown Simpson, may we always cherish her memories. Nicole was a beacon of light that burned bright. May we never forget her.
And Gloria Allred, who represented Nicole Brown Simpson's family during that murder trial, put out a statement saying, "Simpson's death reminds us that the legal system, even 30 years later, is still failing battered women, and that the power of celebrity men to avoid true justice for the harm that they inflict on their wives or significant others is still a major obstacle to the right of women to be free of the gender violence to which they are still subjected." So a lot of people reacting today to the death of O.J. Simpson.
So you could see people reacting, but, you know, I think that other than the family of O.J. Simpson and maybe close friends, I don't think there's too many people on this earth that are shedding tears for him right now. You know, he will always be viewed, in my view, as a murderer. You know, even all the great things he did in life prior to this, that incident can't erase or can't. That incident will be what he's remembered for. And even though a jury found him not guilty, I think that with a jury of public opinion, and we don't matter really, because he walked, he was free, right? But we believe that he's a murderer. And we, including whoever thinks that way, I'm not telling anyone out there who thinks he's innocent what to think. But this is what my opinion is here based on what I see as the evidence. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, share us with your friends and your family, and hit the like button. If you want to contribute to us, we have a Patreon with three different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels, and we appreciate. Yes, Nina Chandra, he's a double murderer. Yeah, a double murderer. Hey, it's Jay from the chat. He was a narcissistic sociopath who was a violent abuser and lying murderer. So he's in hell now where he belongs. He never shed a tear. And so why should we? Be gone, evil. Wow. Couldn't have said it better myself. Julia Ann, Bill, you said it. Actor. Yeah, he was a good actor. He knew how to act. You know, he definitely, and he came across, he was a charming guy. He was a likable guy from his public perspective. I don't think there anyone before this had a bad thing to say about OJ, unless you knew him intimately. This case raises so much emotion on so many different levels. I want to play a little bit of this. This was an interview of Cato Kalin, a little more in depth than we just saw, but he was sort of the old California character, the slacker who lived it seemingly for free at OJ's home.
CEO statement.
I've been asked to comment on the death of OJ Simpson. Foremost, I'd like to express my condolences to the children, to Sydney and to Justin, to Jason and Arnell. They lost their father, and that is never easy. I wish to express my love and compassion to the Goldmans, to Fred and to Kim. I hope you find closure. And finally, to the family of the beautiful Nicole Brown Simpson. May we always cherish her memories. Nicole was a beacon of light that burned bright. May we never forget her.
And Cato Kalin is kind enough to join me live now in this News Nation exclusive. Cato, it's good to see you again. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the program tonight.
Hello.
It's such a weird question to say, how are you doing, you know, especially today. But I do want to know how this news hit you this morning.
Well, listening to your monologue, which was so eloquent, and I have to tell you that I'm sitting in this chair, and you took me like in a time machine back, and honestly, so many emotions were just brewing inside me, and it brought me back to 1994 and 95. And as far as this morning goes, I got up this morning and just saw over 100 messages, and immediately in my head, I just said, someone died. And after looking at the news stories, I saw that it was O.J. Simpson, and I wasn't going to do any sort of statement. And I just had I was inundated with so many things. I said, the best thing I could do is to sit down in my own feelings and give it some time and to express what you just played on your show. And it's true. And you know what? I'm thinking of the Browns family and Fred and Kim Goldman. And I don't think there ever will be closure because of what you said. I mean, there's closure because he's dead, but they live it every day. They miss their son, and the Browns miss their daughter. It's and of course Kim misses her brother, but there's closure, but it goes on forever. There never really will be. They'll miss. They can't be brought back to life.
Well, you know what? It was really gracious and eloquent of you to put out that statement that strictly addressed those who have been so deeply affected, including OJ's kids, because some people might forget they lost their mother in a gruesome murder, and they have dealt with the aftermath of what the OJ image, you know, has become, who is the only parent they had left. How have you been able to process? Have you ever had any connection to any of these players since the trial?
You know, actually, after the trial happened, I made a sort of an oath to myself. I wanted to move forward because that's just really a dark period. And you know me somewhat. I'm really about light and laughter. And that part, I wanted to be past. There's nothing I could do about the past. It's everything I was doing had to be present. I can always work that and make my future better, make future better for everybody else. So that's what I focused on. And I didn't go past. I mean, I had some messages from Tanya on Facebook, Tanya Brown. I did Kim's podcast. And so those parts I did, it was a cathartic for me. But everything else I'm doing is just to make things better, not just for myself, for other people that, in my life. And I've lived by the motto since being raised by my beautiful parents in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, large family, is always pay it forward and make life better for the next person. And I believe in that. I do that every moment.
You know, it's when we were going over those materials at the beginning of the show, it really does sort of catapult you back, but it's still hard to believe 29 years, right? Like, that is just a lifetime. And so many of the people I work with weren't alive for this. I really wonder how, because, you know, back then we didn't talk about PTSD, right? We just didn't. It wasn't a thing. Now it is. Do you think that you suffered from PTSD? Do you have a place in your contemplation today where you have to really address what you went through and how it completely overturned your life?
I'll tell you the truth. I'm blessed that I have the best friends in the world, the best family in the world, because when you have that backing, you can conquer anything. And they not only keep you humble, but their word, their guidance make things a-okay. You know, actually, you think about the trial. It's going on 30 years, what happened. And I really believe that it will go on forever, long before I'm past, because it's a template of that trial. And everything's going to be compared to that trial. I mean, you had a ESPN doing an Oscar-winning documentary. You had a show with Ryan Murphy producing that won 8 Emmys. And it's all about this trial. And every trial will be compared to that one. And like I said, it's never going to end. It'll go on forever. But as far as the PTSD, no suffering at all.
I'm so glad to hear that, because, you know, the when a horrible crime happens, there is a reverberation, a huge ripple effect on so many people, not just those who are close in the family, but others, friends, associates, those who are swept up, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there's no more example of that than this trial. People had no idea what was coming, yeah, coming their way. And I know that you've said before you believe OJ was guilty. I think you also said that he would never confess, not even on his deathbed, and that's where we are. So I suppose you're not surprised, right, that we've landed on this day this way.
Well, I believe in God, I believe in heaven, and I sure hope I end up there, even if it's a guest house up there. But I hope I end up in heaven. And I don't know if he had that moment of penance where you had that saying in your last moments on your deathbed. But I doubt it. I don't know. I just think, boy, I would think a person has to make peace with their maker. So I'm pretty sure that he kept everything until the day he died. Only he knows.
How do you think O.J. Simpson will be remembered, given the extraordinary fissure in society, mostly along racial lines, when the verdict came down, and then the 29 years since, and all the behaviors we've seen him display?
Well, the point you're saying is terrific, because of the Simpson trial, of the verdict, we had split screens of white and black reactions, and we all saw it. It was played over and over on TV's 150 million people, and it was repetition. And that just brought us so far back as a society. And we've never recovered. And then we had the George Floyd situation, and it got even worse, and it's on that way. And I live in LA, and I gotta tell you, LA, crime is accepted. You can shoplift up to $850 and not be arrested. And if it's acceptable to have crime, there's gonna be more and more criminals. And it'll never be fixed, and we're gonna continue to be backward as a society.
You know, what he's talking about is sort of sad. The George Floyd incident, which was the recent incident which has led to sort of a bigger racial divide than we had even before that, which we go back almost 30 years to the O.J. Simpson trial. And it was split, of course, among a racial divide. And that's a sad thing. It's a very sad thing. Folks, if you're looking for a great attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer and a fantastic defense attorney. You can reach Joe on his cell phone at 718-514-3855. Email him at joe@jmurray-law.com. I'll go on his website, jmurray-law.com. Not only is Joe a fantastic defense attorney, but a huge supporter of the Police Off the Cuff podcast, and we appreciate everything Joe has done for us. You know, there was another thing that was very interesting in this case, and that was the book that O.J. Simpson attempted to write, and it was entitled If I Did It, and he was supposed to tell his story to a ghostwriter, and apparently it fell apart when the civil case, of course, hit, and any money he made would go to the Goldmans and the people, Nicole Brown Simpson's family, in regards to any money that he could potentially make off that. I want to play a little bit of the ghostwriter because he also, in writing this book, and actually he was a witness at the trial, felt that O.J. Simpson was guilty.
Well, what happened was I got a call from the publisher, Judith Regan, and she said she had this project with O.J., and I said, you know, I testified against him. I'm completely the wrong guy for this project. But, you know, I'd done a number of bestsellers for Judith, and she trusted me, and she thought that if anybody was going to elicit an actual confession out of O.J., I might be that person. So initially, I said I didn't really want to go into business with him, and the legal team over at HarperCollins sent over documentation, and I saw that the deal was made with his children. And I figured, well, you know, if they get a little something out of this, it's not a bad thing. So I signed on and got on a plane to Miami and flew down to meet OJ.
He said,
the first thing
go ahead.
He said to me was, you know, the opening words, you know, we shook hands and he goes, have you ever heard of a man being put away for murder by a wailing dog?
Wow.
And so he was basically saying, I know who you are and I remember who you are. And we sat down and had lunch and, you know, got off to a slow start, but things took off from there.
Do you think that that was maybe one of the reasons why he agreed to do it? What was in it for him to have you, someone who testified against him, as his ghostwriter?
You know, I don't know if he gave it that much thought, you know, that somebody presented a deal to him, and I guess he thought the terms were agreeable, and he just, well, let's get this done. Let's do this job. And we sat down, and it's a form of therapy. Ghostwriting is a lot like therapy, you know, for the client. They sit there and you walk them through their history. In this particular case, it was one chapter of his history that everyone was interested in, and so that's what we focused on.
So you said that he never expressed any remorse in the course of your working with him. Did you think he was guilty while you were writing this book?
Oh, you know what, at one point, you know, we're in the hotel suite working together, and we'd been working for a few days, and he said, you know, Pablo, now that you know me a little better and maybe like me a little bit, do you still think I did it? And I said, I'm sorry, OJ, I thought you did it when it happened a dozen years ago, and I still think you did it. And he exploded, and it was a lot of theatrics because a few moments later, he was laughing, and he said, I know you think I'm guilty. And he thanked me for being honest with him. And as I've said in the past, it wasn't, you know, like I'm a big, brave writer. It's just that we were in the middle of working on a book together. And if I had lied to him at that point, it would not have helped the project in any way. So I was just honest with him.
you describe him as someone who would explode at you in moments like that and then minutes later start laughing. I mean, explain to us what kind of person, someone who spent a lot of time in book therapy with him, what kind of person really is O.J. Simpson?
Well, you know, for a while I thought, you know, maybe there was a lot of cognitive dissonance there and that maybe he really didn't think he had done it. But the more time I spent with him, the more I felt that he knew he had done it, because as we got closer to that chapter on the murders, it became harder and harder for him to deal with. I mean, it was a real struggle. I mean, he never fell apart and he didn't cry, but he was, you know, he was angry and worked up as we got to that chapter. He kept saying, "I hate this chapter. I hate this chapter. Do we have to do this chapter?" And I said, "That's the only reason we're doing the book. It's this chapter."
This chapter.
But the other thing that I thought was interesting, the chapter about the murders. And the other thing that I thought was interesting is, you know, he, in the book, when he talked about meeting Nicole, it was incredibly romantic, you know, a young waitress in a coffee shop in Beverly Hills. And then, you know, as we got deeper into sort of the marital issues and the abuse, he was just getting angrier and angrier and, you know, saying they turned me into the poster boy for wife abuse. And he basically was murdering her character in the book. Everything that went wrong in the marriage was her fault. And there was this sort of weird sense that, you know, he was saying, if I did it, she had it coming. And that was really chilling to me. And it was, you know, it just showed what I was dealing with.
He at some point tried to turn the public against you. Why?
Well, I thought that was, you know, I'm sorry, I found it kind of amusing. What happened was the National Enquirer broke the news about the book, and suddenly there was a, you know, like a storm, and the Goldmans were on, you know, on the TV every day decrying the people who were involved in the book, and it wasn't pleasant. It didn't really affect me. I have a complete other life outside of the book business, but OJ decided, you know, if the book is a confession, you know, maybe Pablo did it. I mean, he, you know, he lives just, you know, 50 yards from Nicole's house. So, and he seems to know so much about the murder. So he basically was throwing me under the bus a little bit.
Crazy, right? That was the interview of Pablo Fengis, who wrote the book, If I Did It, this is how I would have done it. And the whole concept was crazy. So, folks, that's about all I'm going to cover on this. I mean, there was this case, for those that maybe were too young to appreciate it. There it goes, the thumbnail on the screen. O.J. Simpson is dead at the age of 76. And how he will be remembered, I think he'll be remembered as a murderer, you know, regardless of what you remember of this trial and what you see on the screen, the dream team. I want to also say I find it a little bit disturbing, and maybe it's naive of me, but to think that an attorney knows you're a murderer, but still, I guess that's their job. They still give you the best defense, even though they know in their heart you did it. And I think all of these attorneys that you see on the screen there, Johnny Cochran, Robert Shapiro, is the Kardashian dad sitting between F. Lee Bailey and O.J. F. Lee Bailey, they said he was the only attorney that believed that O.J. actually was innocent. When you think about it, even when he did get acquitted, there was nothing funny or joyful about it. You know, he got off. Yeah, he got off. So we another murderer walking free out there. That's the way I looked at it. And again, if you think that he's innocent, you know, you can think whatever you want. I think that this jury, I don't know if I could say they're probably the stupidest jury ever assembled, or that they knew what they were doing. They were smart and they just wouldn't convict no matter how much evidence was there. But if they actually really saw all that evidence and took it in and they still acquitted it, then I would say you're the stupidest jury that ever sat in a jury box in the history of mankind. You know, anyway, that's the show, folks. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Cannon, Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. Have a great day, everyone. One episode, just ain't enough.